Presented a lot of information about why I believe the little horn best fits the papacy. And if you have any questions about that further, I'd be happy to discuss it. As I said a couple nights ago, this is the conclusion I've come to on the basis of my own studies. It seems that the history lines right up with the prophecy that God has given us in Daniel chapter 7. And for that reason, that's what drew me to this particular interpretation. It seems to make the most sense. We left off last night talking about a very curious statement in the 25th verse of Daniel chapter 7. Pages stuck together. And that is this this time period of time times and half a time. And last night I spent a few minutes talking about how this time period is represented in various ways in the Bible. Sometimes it's called 1,260 days, sometimes it's called time times and half a time, and sometimes it's called 42 months. We looked at how you could do this through calculation by using a lunar calendar, which the Israelites would have used, a 12-month lunar calendar. But we also looked at how, if you just take the passages that these three time periods are mentioned, you can find that they are synonymous in many ways. We compared, Revelation 12:6 to 12:14. In 12:6, we're told that the serpent pursued the woman for a period of 1,260 days. And in 12:14, it says that she was nourished in the wilderness for a time, times, and half a time. And those just seem to correspond to one another. They just seem to line right up, seem to be referring to the same thing. Then we also looked at how 1,260 days equals 42 months, and that is not only through multiplication. If we take 42 months and multiply that by 30, we get 1,260. But we also can see that the way this is used, particularly in Revelation chapters 12 and 13, that these two time periods seem to line up, that they're talking about the same length of time. The church, or the woman, fled from the dragon for 1,260 days in Revelation 12:6. In chapter 13, verse 2, we're introduced to this beast that the dragon gives authority. We're told in verses 5 and 7 of that same chapter that that authority is given for a period of 42 months, and that authority was for the express purpose of persecuting God's people. So, the dragon which sought to kill the woman, which I believe is representative of the people of God, the church, the dragon who pursued her into the wilderness for a period of 1,260 days, through his agency of the beast, seeks to persecute the saints for this period of 42 months. So I think it's fairly logical to conclude that 1,260 days and 42 months are the same, not just for the sake of mathematics, but also because of how they are used in those passages. And I concluded last night with just this little syllogism. If 1,260 days equals time times and half a time, and if 1,260 days equals 42 months, then time times and half a time equals 42 months. So we're talking about the same time period here. Now I think it's necessary for us to turn to the question that is perhaps the most difficult to answer. As I mentioned when we began the seventh chapter, this chapter is heavily symbolic in nature, a lot of figurative language. And in order to interpret figurative language in the Bible, we need to use the Bible as its own dictionary, because God's the one who has expressed himself in such ways so that he could be understood by his people, not just in passages like this, but elsewhere, looking at other places in the Bible to determine what is God's meaning. So the question is, are these a literal 1,260 days, or is God speaking figuratively? There is precedent in the Bible, particularly in the Old Testament, for a day being equal to 1 year. You'll recall in the book of Leviticus, chapter 25, verse 4, God establishes for the children of Israel a Sabbath rest for the land. They were allowed to plant for 6 years, and in the seventh they were to let the land lie fallow. Why 6 years and 1 year of rest? What's the justification for that? Because God created the world in 6 days, and on the seventh day he rested, right? So there's a correlation. A day for a year. 6 days of creation, 1 day of rest. 6 years of planting and harvesting, 1 year of rest. We see in Numbers chapter 14, verse 34, that the children of Israel were sentenced to 40 years of wandering in the wilderness because their spies had spent 40 days in the land of Canaan spying out that land, and 10 of them had come back with a negative report. So 1 year of wandering for every day of spying. So in these two cases, we see that there is some precedent for the idea of a day being equal to a year, at least in a figurative way. But the real, I guess you might say, passage that sort of cinches it for me is over in the fourth chapter of the book of Ezekiel. Ezekiel and Daniel were contemporaries of one another. Daniel was in the capital of the Babylonian kingdom. Ezekiel came later on in the second wave of captives in 597. He's in a different part of Babylon. And in the fourth chapter of Ezekiel, after he's been called to prophesy to the people, God has him lay on one side of his body for 390 days. And God says in that chapter that those 390 days represent 390 years. Then he tells him to flip over and lay on his other side for 40 days, which God says are equal to 40 years. 1 day for 1 year. I think when we put this together, what we can be led to conclude is that it is possible within prophecy to interpret a day as a year. That possibility is out there. So if that's true, when does this 1,260 years begin? Well, last night I mentioned the formulary of Pope Hormisdas. If you don't remember what that is, I wouldn't be surprised by that. I read quite a lot of things last night, and it may have gotten lost in your memory. This formulary was a document that the Pope had put together, and he insisted that not only the Emperor of the Eastern Empire sign it, but that all of the bishops in the Church sign it. And this document was an acknowledgement on the part of both the bishops and the Emperor of the supremacy of the Bishop of Rome. And let me just go ahead and reread for you this formulary. This is just a quotation from part of it. Quote, "The first condition of salvation is to preserve the standard of true faith and not to forsake the tradition of the fathers. The saying of Christ, 'Thou art Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church,' cannot be annulled. These words have been verified for the Apostolic See," and that's the Bishop of Rome. "The Apostolic See has always preserved untainted the Catholic religion. By following in every respect the Apostolic See," the Bishop of Rome, the Pope, "by teaching what it has already established, we hope to abide with you in this sole communion which the Apostolic See proclaims, in which verily is to be found all the power of the Christian religion." I think this is an astounding document because this was signed by most of the bishops in the church and also by the emperor of the Eastern Roman Empire at the time, Justinian. And in this, they are acknowledging the primacy of the Bishop of Rome, that even though he may wear the same title as other men, even though he may be a bishop, there is, by virtue of the fact that he sits in the chair of Peter, purportedly, there is, by virtue of that fact, a supremacy. And that supremacy was acknowledged by all the men who signed that document, including the emperor himself. And on March 16, 536, Justinian, emperor of the East, signed that document. What's interesting about that date is if you go 1,260 years later, On March 27th, 1796, Napoleon invades Italy. Now, that may not sound like all that important of an event, but that was a significant event in European and world history. For the first time in centuries, an army was invading Italy for the express purpose of confining the power of the Church of Rome. And Napoleon was successful in this. Not only did he invade Italy, but he ends up taking Rome, arresting the Pope, and hauling him back to France and holding him under arrest for a period of several years. This was a significant development. It had been many years since such a thing had taken place. And in fact, if my memory serves me correct, I cannot recall another instance where the Bishop of Rome was ever arrested and held under house arrest. My memory might be failing me, but I can't recall a single moment when that took place. This was a significant development. And if we tie this together with something we read in the book of Revelation, and I know I'm kind of jumping the gun just a little bit here, but over in Revelation chapter 16, in the third vial, and I'm only mentioning this because I think this is just an interesting connection to make. When the third angel pours out his bowl on the rivers of springs and water, they become blood in Revelation 16 and 4. John hears the angel of the water saying, "You are righteous, O Lord, the one who is and who was and who is to be, because you have judged these things. For they have shed the blood of saints and prophets, and you have given them blood to drink, for it is their just due." If my understanding of Revelation is correct, Revelation chapter 16 verses 4, 5, and 6 represent Napoleon invading Italy. The vial is poured out on the springs and upon the rivers. We have a lot of rivers flowing down from the Alps down into Italy, down to the south. And what's interesting about this particular bowl is the angelic commentary. The angel says this is their just due. They have persecuted the saints. And if we connect that back together with Daniel chapter 7, you recall that the saints were given into the hand of the little horn for a time, times, and half a time. And during that time period, we're also told he persecuted the saints. And it's with this bowl that that power is finally checked, and I see this as the conclusion of that particular time period. So I believe that this 1,260 years stretches across the Dark Ages into what we call the European Renaissance, into the Reformation, into the era of the Enlightenment, and then finally ends at the end of the 18th century with the French Revolution and with the checking of the papal power by Napoleon in this event and some others that we read about in the book of Revelation. So that's my understanding of the time, times, and half a time. And I realize that I'm leaving some holes there. I must admit I've got to move on to chapter 8 tonight, or I may not get to chapter 9 Friday night, and I would really like to do that. So I'll pause here to ask, are there any questions or comments about chapter 7? That's my understanding of it. And if you don't feel like you've got time to ask me the question now, maybe we can talk about it later. Any questions or comments before we move on to chapter 8?
This is all B.C., right?
This is all A.D. It's all A.D. 536 A.D. to 1796 A.D. Yeah. We are after the decline and fall of the Roman Empire in 536. The city of Rome was conquered about 60 years before this. So we are getting close to the Dark Ages, which I think we would say begins somewhere around 600 AD. So we cover that entire time period and forward up until the French Revolution. Any other questions or comments? I think what you'll find is if you sit in on Rick's class this summer, our dates on the 1,260 years differ by about 3 years. I think he tends to interpret this as beginning in 533. I don't want to put words in his mouth, but I'm just saying there may be some disagreement. What I think is interesting, though, is that we're talking about the same essentially the same time period within about 5 or 10 years, which I think is particularly convicting. There really is something to this 1,260 years, and it's really something to see. Any questions or comments? All right, let's jump over to chapter 8 real quick. I don't plan to talk about chapter 8 in its entirety. I feel like we've already talked, I won't say enough, but we've talked, yeah, I guess I will say, we've talked enough about Greece and Persia for me to sort of skate over the first part of chapter 8. Chapter 8 deals basically with the fall of Persia to the Greeks, and then it deals with one of those Greek powers that took over for Alexander the Great, and from that single power comes a very significant person. So we've got the Greeks versus the Persians here, and one of the nice things about chapter 8 is that we get quite a bit of help from the angels in understanding what exactly all this means. The Greeks and the Persians are very clearly identified in verses 20 and 21. In verse 20, the angel tells us that the ram which you saw, speaking to Daniel, having the two horns, they are the kings of Media and Persia, and the male goat is the kingdom of Greece. The large horn that is between its eyes is the first king, which would be Alexander the Great. So we have a lot of help in interpreting this particular vision correctly. You'll recall from a couple nights ago, we were looking at Daniel chapter 7. We talked about the leopard that had the four heads. And we talked about how those four heads represented the four generals that eventually divided up the empire of Alexander the Great. And I went ahead and listed their four names up here. Cassander and Lysimachus are two of those generals. They took over territories that were much smaller, and they sort of fade into the background within a few decades. The two that we want to focus our attention on are Seleucus and Ptolemy. Those are the two most significant generals. They rule the most significant area of Alexander's former empire. And we do have them alluded to in this particular vision. So I wanted to be sure that we reviewed that and it was in your mind. Now here in this eighth chapter, we're introduced to another little horn. Let's just pick up in verse number 8 and let's read. And I think as we go along, you're going to see how this imagery all fits together. Therefore the male goat grew very great. The male goat is Greece. But when he became strong, the large horn was broken. That would be Alexander the Great. He died. And in place of it, four notable ones came up toward the four winds of heaven. That's Cassander, Lysimachus, Seleucus, and Ptolemy. Toward the four winds of heaven, four corners, if you will. Every direction of his empire, it was divided up among those four. Verse 9, and out of one of them came a little horn, which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the glorious land. And it grew up to the host of heaven, and it cast down some of the host and some of the stars to the ground and trampled them. He even exalted himself as high as the prince of the host. And by him the daily sacrifices were taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. Because of transgression, an army was given over to the horn to oppose daily sacrifice, and he cast truth down to the ground. He did all this and prospered. All right. So we have coming out of one of these horns, out of one of these four, this little horn. And this little horn is quite different than the little horn that we had in Daniel chapter 7. And I think you'll begin to notice the differences. There are some similarities, which I think is very interesting. I don't know if you're familiar with the concept of an archetype. An archetype is, it's basically like this characteristics or ideals that pop up time and time and time again in literature, in stories, in legends and fables. And there are a lot of archetypal sort of things going on in the Bible. There's a lot of similarities. Like when you begin comparing this little horn to the little horn of Daniel chapter 7, to the king of Tyre in Ezekiel 26, to the king of Babylon in Isaiah 14, you begin to notice a lot of similarities. There are a lot of characteristics all these men share. There's a lot of pride, there's a lot of arrogance, there's a lot of pride to the point of placing themselves in a position that only God deserves. I think that's evidenced by Nebuchadnezzar in the story of his dream that we reviewed with the children tonight. So there is a lot of archetypal material in these characters in prophetic language. So I don't want to be confused too much by that, because we have here a little horn that is growing out of the Greek kingdom. Now the little horn we saw back in chapter 7 is growing out of the Roman kingdom, out of the Roman power. And this one, even though he's going to have some of the same characteristics, is going to differ in some significant ways. Now I wanted to take just a moment. I don't know how well you can see this map. I tried to make it really big so that hopefully everyone can see it. This is, as it says up there at the top, the Hellenistic world in the 3rd century BC, so between 200 and 300 BC. In the red there, you see the Seleucid kingdom. This was the territory from Alexander the Great's empire that had been turned over to the rule of the general Seleucus. Then down in the south, in the blue there in northern Egypt and running along the Red Sea and the Nile River, you'll see the Ptolemaic kingdom, the kingdom that was turned over to Ptolemy. Do you see the big black circle I put up there? Everybody see that? What's that big black circle basically around? Israel, right? And notice that the dividing line between these two empires runs right in the middle of Israel. There is a big tug of war that takes place between these two kingdoms, and Israel is right in the middle of it. There is a lot of instability, a lot of unrest for a period of about 150 years for the Jewish people, because they are smack dab in the middle of this tussle between these two kingdoms. So this particular piece of history is important to the Jewish people. Remember, after Malachi wrote somewhere around 400 BC, we have a period of silence that lasts until the conception of John the Baptist, when his father Zechariah begins to prophesy. In between that time period, it's made very clear by Josephus and by others that there is no prophetic inspiration. There is silence from God. But that doesn't mean that nothing's happening in the land of Israel. And a lot of the book of Daniel, it helps us fill in the blanks between Malachi and Matthew, that there are things going on. And this struggle between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies is one of the major troubles that Israel faces in this intermediary time period. All right, let's get into this. I don't know that I'm going to have time for this slide, so I'm just going to go through that. Okay, so let's talk about the little horn. I'm already starting to run out of time, so I may skip just a little bit here to get the main points. Who is this little horn? You see up there on the slide a very unusual name. Antiochus Epiphanes. Antiochus Epiphanes was a descendant of Seleucus, the general Seleucus. And he was ruling over the land of Israel in the 2nd century B.C. And I believe that the little horn here in Daniel chapter 8 represents Antiochus Epiphanes. He plays a major part, not only in Daniel chapter 8, but also in Daniel chapter 11, which we're not going to have time to get to this week. But if it interests you more, I would recommend that you take a look at Daniel chapter 11, because he plays a very prominent role, really from about somewhere in the 20s, verse 20 onward. All right. This little horn is Antiochus Epiphanes, and let's just start by reading a couple of things about him in verse 9 and verses 23 and 24. In verse 9, the angel, or excuse me, Daniel says in his vision, out of one of them, out of one of the horns, so this would be the horn of Seleucus, out of one of them came a little horn which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the glorious land. Now let's scan down to verse 23 and 24. And in the latter time of their kingdom, that would be the Greek kingdom, when the transgressors have reached their fullness, a king shall arise, this would be the little horn, having fierce features, who understands sinister schemes. His power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. He shall destroy fearfully, and shall prosper and thrive. He shall destroy the mighty and also the holy people. So out of this horn, this main horn, out of Seleucus comes this little horn. And we get the sense that Antiochus Epiphanes is not a terribly likable guy. Right? He's not terribly likable. Now the Seleucids had remained, will remain the greatest power in Asia until the Roman conquest in 64 BC. So they are a significant power in this area. Antiochus Epiphanes, or Antiochus the Fourth, as he's sometimes called, he's sometimes also referred to as Antiochus Illustrious, which is the translation of Epiphanes. Anyways, this man was one of a kind. Let me read you a quotation from Durant about him. Antiochus the Fourth was both the most interesting and the most erratic of his line. A rare mixture of intellect, insanity, and charm. He governed the kingdom ably, despite 1,000 injustices and absurdities. He allowed his delegates to abuse their power and gave his mistress authority over 3 cities. He was generous and cruel without judgment, often forgiving or condemning by whim, surprising simple folk with costly gifts, and tossing money with a child's ecstasy among the crowds in the streets. Sounds like kind of an odd guy, doesn't it? A rare mixture of intellect, insanity, and charm, says Durant. He goes on to say, the chief effect of his passion for things Roman was the introduction of gladiatorial games in Antioch's capital. The people resented the brutal sport, but Antiochus won them over by lavish and spectacular displays when they became accustomed to the butchery. He considered their degeneration a personal victory. Remember what the Bible says about Antiochus in verse 23. He has fierce features. He destroys fearfully. This was not a warm and fuzzy man. He was a fairly unlikable character. He was fierce. We're also told that he understands sinister schemes, verse 23. Going on in verse 25, through his cunning he shall cause deceit to prosper under his rule, and he shall exalt himself in his heart, he shall destroy many in their prosperity, he shall even rise against the prince of princes, but he shall be broken without human means. Through his cunning he will cause deceit to prosper under his rule. Antiochus was ruling over the Jewish people at this time, and he used the high priesthood as a way to control the Jewish people. So in other words, he tried to use the systems that were already in place in order to bring the nation of Judah under his control. The high priesthood under Antiochus Epiphanes became a political office to be sold to the highest bidder. No longer was it based upon descent, it was based upon the depths of one's pocketbook. Antiochus removed Onias from the high priesthood and substituted Jason, his brother. Jason promised to pay Antiochus the sum of 360 talents yearly. That's why he removed Onias and replaced him with Jason, because Jason promised to pay him this amount on a yearly basis. So this was a man who was very shrewd politically and used the political mechanisms of the Jews in order to be sort of their their puppeteer, if you will. We also notice in verses 9 and 10 how this little horn grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, toward the glorious land. It grew up to the host of heaven. It cast down some of the host and some of the stars to the ground and trampled them. Here we get a sense of Antiochus Epiphanes' success in battle. Pushes to the south, to the east, and toward the glorious land. In 175, Antiochus Epiphanes comes to the Seleucid throne. He makes Jason the high priest. In 173, he enters into a league with Rome, secured by a 500-pound gift of golden vessels. In 169, he invades Egypt, captures Ptolemy VI, withdraws, puts down a revolt in Jerusalem, plunders the temple. He sets out in 166 to the east and begins conquering. In 165, he defeats the Armenians. So he pushes down to the south into Egypt. He's moving into the glorious land, which would be the land of Israel. He pushes off toward the east. He conquers Armenia, which would have been up toward the north and the east of Jerusalem. And then he pushes off toward the east, toward Persia, towards Babylon, and conquers over that direction. He has a great deal of military success, at least against those who are not of Jewish descent. So this is the rise of Antiochus Epiphanes. He comes to power. He uses the high priesthood. He understands sinister schemes. He's a political man. He understands how to control people. He expands his kingdom. No one is able to stand in front of him. We also see here that Antiochus Epiphanes was a blasphemous man. Notice back in verse number 11. In verse number 11, he says, he even exalted himself as high as the prince of the host, and by him the daily sacrifices were taken away. We notice down in verse 25, he shall exalt himself in his heart. This is a man who thought of himself more highly than he ought to think. Durant says this of Antiochus, that he enjoyed his own qualities so keenly that he labeled his coins Antiochus Theos Epiphanes, the God made manifest. The word Theos is the Greek word for God. So he, on all of his currency, on all of his coins, inscribes them with Antiochus Theos Epiphanes. The God made manifest. The God made manifest. At times, Durant says, it seems Antiochus thought of establishing and requiring the worship of himself as a god. So, here is a man who really was placing himself in a position he did not belong. He exalted himself, as Daniel says in Daniel chapter 8, verse 11, as high as the prince of the host. He shall exalt himself in his heart, says the angel later on in verse 25. In verse number 12, we see his movement to Hellenize the Jewish people alluded to. In verse number 12, because of transgression, an army was given over to the horn to oppose the daily sacrifices, and he cast truth down to the ground. He did all this and prospered. You'll recall when Alexander the Great invaded all these foreign lands, he made efforts to Hellenize those lands. He insisted that those lands speak Greek. He insisted that those lands begin to worship Greek gods. But he allowed the Jewish people, because they surrendered, and according to Josephus, because they took to him the 8th chapter of Daniel and said, look, you're the horn right here. You're the horn that's conquering Persia. He allowed them to keep their own language, to keep their own customs, and to pretty much be on their own without the influence of Greek thought, Greek literature, Greek religion, etc. Antiochus Epiphanes, though, did not allow this to happen. When Antiochus Epiphanes went on his second campaign through Egypt in 170 BC, a false report of his death reached Jerusalem. And the rejoicing Jews, when they received word of this, deposed his appointees, massacred the leaders of the Hellenizing party, and cleansed the temple of what they felt to be pagan abominations. So they received word of his death. They massacred all of his representatives in the city, including those Jews who were sympathetic to his Hellenization efforts. And they cleansed the temple of some of the abominations that Antiochus Epiphanes had allowed to take place. Now, when Antiochus Epiphanes learned of their actions, he feared the Jews intended to return themselves to the rule of the Ptolemies, and so he sets his army out on a course for Judea. When Antiochus marched up to Jerusalem, he slaughtered Jews of either sex by the thousand, desecrated and looted the temple, appropriated for the royal coffers its golden altar, its vessels, and its treasures, restored Menelaus to supreme power, and gave orders for the compulsory Hellenization of all Jews. In other words, up to this time, he was sort of moving behind the scenes, allowing his men within the Jewish nation to slowly influence them. But once they began to rebel against his power, then he made it an absolute requirement that the Jews begin to adopt Hellenistic culture, Hellenistic religion, Hellenistic literature, etc., etc. I hope you get the idea there. It's during this time that Antiochus sacrificed on the altar there in Jerusalem a swine, and with the broth of its flesh he sprinkled the temple. He carried 1,800 talents from the temple and returned to Antioch. He left Menelaus, who was worse than all the rest and who had the most malicious attitude toward the Jews, to rule the citizens with a heavy hand. He's desecrated the temple. He is seeking to Hellenize the Jewish people. And this, I think, is fulfillment of what it's talking about in verse 12. Because of transgression, an army was given over to the horn to oppose daily sacrifices. He cast truth down to the ground. He did all this and prospered. It would appear, based on all this, that Antiochus was going to overcome the Jewish people. But what happens as a result of this is the growth of an indigenous Jewish group called the Chasidim. If you've ever heard of Hasidic Jews, if you've heard that title before, Hasidic Jews, that's where that word comes from the Hasidim, I think is how it's pronounced. Hasidic, Hasidim. The Hasidim also were the precursors to the Pharisees. These are the early Pharisees, if you will, the progenitors of who would later become the Pharisees. The Chasidim believed in a strict observation of the law, and they won the hearts of the people because of their righteousness. They were shocked by the developments within the Jewish nation. They felt their religion was challenged, and the majority of Jewish people thought they were right. They went over to them, and their numbers began to swell. And it's the Chasidim that eventually fight alongside the Maccabees in the revolt that takes place in a few years. You've probably heard the name Maccabee before. There's even an apocryphal book, although I don't know that it's really apocryphal. It's a good book of history. First and Second Maccabees give this entire history, and it's the Maccabees, Judas Maccabee, and those who were related to him that lead the revolt, the rebellion against Antiochus Epiphanes a little later on. And they were joined by the Chasidim in this. So we have, I guess you might say, an action-reaction going on. You've got this imposition of Greek culture upon the people of God, and then you had the people of God saying, no, we want to hold to our law, we want to hold to our customs, our traditions, we do not want to lose our identity. And they decide to fight against the encroachment of Greek culture. Now in verses 11, 13, and 23 through 25, we see that there was a time during all this that the worship of Jehovah was outlawed and the temple was desecrated. We've read verse 11 several times. Notice verse 13. Daniel hears a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to that certain one who was speaking, "How long will the vision be concerning the daily sacrifices and the transgression of desolation, the giving of both the sanctuary and the host to be trampled underfoot?" Notice the giving of both the sanctuary and the host to be trampled underfoot. In other words, the sanctuary has been turned over from its rightful owner and given over to this abominable man. In verses 23 through 25, it talks about how, let's see, what am I missing here? I'm not exactly sure what I wanted in verses 23 through 25. You can write that down, but I don't know that it really fits the point I'm making here. So, hey, there you go. You can't get every... Sometimes you just... You ever have those moments where you throw something in your notes and you're not really sure why you're there? You're getting one of those moments from me tonight. Okay, there you go. Yeah, this idea of outlawing the worship of God and desecrating the temple comes out at least in verses 11 through 13. All right. Let's get just a little bit more into this, and I want to sketch this out so you get the full scope of what's taking place here. In 167, Antiochus ordered that all the countries that were subject to him observe the same way of divine worship and set aside their peculiar customs. They were all to adopt the same religion as the Greeks under the punishment of death to those who refused. Over every country, he appointed overseers who were to compel them to do this. The king goes on to proclaim to Jerusalem and the cities of Judah that they were to follow the rites of the Gentiles and remove the sacrifices from the temple. They were forbidden to keep the Sabbaths and feast days. They were to pollute the sanctuary and its priests and to erect altars, groves, and temples to idols. They were to sacrifice swine and other unclean beasts, and they had to allow their children to remain uncircumcised. They were, in other words, to defile themselves with every impure thing, so that they would forget the law and change all the ordinances of their God. And there were some Jews who went along with this. There were apostate Jews who erected the detestable idol of Zeus Olympus on the altar in the temple. 10 days later, sacrifices were offered to the idol on that altar of God. At the same time, two women who had circumcised their children were accused. Their children were clinging to them, their arms about their mother's necks. After they had been publicly fled through the city, they were thrown down headlong from the wall. When they had cut to pieces any books of the law which they had found, they burned them in the fire. By the king's command, they executed anyone they found with a book of the testament or who approved of the law. These were just some of the things that were being done to those who endeavored to cling to the Lord, endeavored to cling to God, endeavored to follow after the laws that God had given his people. When Antiochus saw that his edicts were despised by the people, he forced everyone by using torture to eat unclean meats and to renounce Judaism. He ordered every Hebrew to be seized and forced to eat swine's flesh and things that had been offered to idols. If any should refuse the profane meat, they were to be executed after being racked on wheels. These were just some of the things that he did. Outlawing the worship of Jehovah, placing an idol in the temple, offering sacrifices to that idol, executing those who circumcised their children, forcing the Jewish people to eat unclean meat. These were just a few of the atrocities. The length of his tyranny. In verse 13, in his vision, Daniel hears a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to that certain one who was speaking, "How long will the vision be? How long?" Whenever the people of God are under distress, God is often asked, "How long is it going to last?" We see it here in Daniel 8, verse 13. We read about it over in Psalm 80 and 4. "O Lord God of hosts, how long will you be angry against the prayer of your people? In Zechariah 1:12, the angel of the Lord answered and said, O Lord of hosts, how long will you not have mercy on Jerusalem and on the cities of Judah against which you were angry these 70 years? In Revelation chapter 6, verse 10, in the fifth seal, John sees the souls of those who had been beheaded for the testimony of Jesus Christ, those who had given their lives for their beliefs. And they cry out with a loud voice saying, How long, O Lord, holy and true, until you judge and avenge our blood on those who dwell on the earth? Here we have a man who is opposing the people of God. He is persecuting them. He is having them do horrendous things. And the question from the angels is, how long, O Lord? How long? How long will you allow this man to prosper? And in verses 14 and 26, we're told that this would last for 2,300 days. Then the sanctuary shall be cleansed. If you go over to verse number 26, notice over in verse 26 in the explanation it says, And the vision of the evenings and mornings, which was told is true, therefore seal up the vision, for it refers to many days in the future. I think this is a little bit different than what we have in the seventh chapter of Daniel because of the nature of the language. At least in my Bible, in verse 14, it gives as an alternate translation of days, says at least in mine, literally evenings and mornings. And that's confirmed by what's said later on in verse 26, evening and morning. You see that phrase, what does that make you think of? It makes me think of creation, right? The evening and the morning were the first day, second day, third day, so on and so forth. The difference in the language between chapter 8 and chapter 7 makes me think that we have something that's a little different in both places. Here I think the intention is for these to be 2,300 literal days, literal evenings and mornings, as opposed to a symbolic day, which we have in chapter 7. We could go into all the reasons for this, but I'm running out of time, so I'm going to have to kick this into overdrive here. We know that the temple was officially cleansed on the 25th day of Chislu, 165 BC. And if we count back from 165, that 25th day of Chislu, if we count back 6 years and 140 days, we are taken to the middle of 171 BC. And that time period puts us right around the time that the high priest Menelaus, who was the worst of all of them, this was the time period that Menelaus came to power. Menelaus was the one who did the most damage. He's the one who sought to Hellenize the Jews on Antiochus Epiphanes' behalf. He was the one who was commissioned to bring the hammer down on those who would not submit. It does seem like this period of 2,300 days does stretch from the beginning of Menelaus' reign as high priest to the moment that the temple is cleansed in 165 BC on the 25th day of Chislu. It's interesting how close that really is. It's just quite amazing. In Daniel chapter 8, verse 25, we're told that Antiochus Epiphanes would die. And notice in verse 25, it says, He shall be broken without human means. In other words, he's not going to be put to death by humans. You might recall a little bit ago, I told you that Antiochus went off on a campaign to the east. Remember, he went down to the south to Egypt, he went toward the glorious land, and he also pushed off toward the east. Well, he did that because the rebellion of the Maccabees was having some success, and it was beginning to drain his coffers. And the only way he could have enough money to keep up his army in Palestine was to go conquer some people over in like Babylon and Persia. I guess that's the way kings made money back in the old days. So that's exactly what he did. I could read to you about the victories of the Maccabees, and they are some stunning victories. They are, I mean, it's obvious when you look at the historical record that God was with these people. There is just no doubt. And I believe that that is a direct fulfillment of what we have here in Daniel chapter 8. But I want to read to you about the death of Antiochus Epiphanes. He begins to hear about all of these monumental losses. He's over in the east, and he keeps getting these reports about the success of the Maccabees back in Palestine. Antiochus had left part of his army back there. He had left the general in charge, and he expected him to carry on in his absence. He pushes off toward the east. He begins hearing that things aren't going so well, so he starts to return to Jerusalem. He's full of fury. He sets out to avenge himself on the Jews for the disgrace he had recently suffered at their hands. He ordered his chariots to go at full speed to hasten the journey home. He proudly bragged that as soon as he arrived at Jerusalem, he would make that city a common burying ground for the Jews. Scarcely had these proud words left Antiochus's mouth when he was struck with an incurable disease in the bowels and extreme pains. It reminds me a little bit of Herod. Remember Herod in the 12th chapter of Acts? How he made those proud statements and all of a sudden he was struck with a malady? Reminds me a little bit of that. Although his body was quite sick, his mind was still sharp. Still breathing out his threats against the Jews, he ordered the chariot driver to increase its pace. It happened that he fell out of his chariot on this fast journey. He was badly hurt. His whole body was bruised and his limbs put out of joint. After he was taken up from the ground, he was carried about on a horse litter. Worms bred so alive in such a pitiful state, and because of the stench, none could endure to carry him, and he became offensive to his whole army. He was forced to stop his journey to Babylon and to stay at Tabus, a town of Persia. He continued bedridden for many days and pined away. We're told that he recognized that this sickness was, I guess you might say, vengeance or repayment for his robbery of the temple, but his contrition did him no good. He died a miserable death in a strange land on the mountains of Parata near Babylon. And that's why the Bible says he shall be broken without human means. It wasn't in battle, it wasn't by a sword, it was by an illness. And he died trying to get back to the land he was endeavoring to conquer. In verse 26, the angel says to Daniel, seal up the vision, for it refers to many days in the future. What he means by that is the vision has reached its conclusion, that there's nothing more to say on this matter, and that it needs to be closed until the fulfillment comes about in a couple of centuries. That is a Reader's Digest version of Daniel chapter 8. And that may seem like it was pretty in-depth, but it's really not. We skipped a lot of details along the way, but it is 8:12, and I need to ring the bell, so we're going to have to conclude for this evening. God willing, we'll pick up in chapter 9 tomorrow night with, as I said last night, what I believe is the most powerful prophecy in the entire Old Testament, the 70 weeks.